will be joining us too. We'll be getting her impression of the extensive travels in the Middle East. Join us after the news.
Urging a strike by British Airways cabin crew to be called off immediately. A three-day walkout will begin at midnight after talks between the Unite Union and BA collapsed. The Prime Minister says both sides should resolve the dispute about jobs, conditions and wages without delay. Jamie Bowden, a former BA spokesman, thinks the airline's chief executive is in a difficult situation.
All airlines at the moment have got to change. I think if you look at what Willie Walsh has done, he is trying to get British Airways into a position so that they're not just sustainable for the future, but where they can return back to some kind of profitability.
Rail passengers are facing disruption after signal workers voted to go on strike in a bitter row over jobs. Both sides, the RMT Union and Network Rail, have agreed to hold peace talks at Conciliation Service ACAS next week. The parents of a former soldier facing the death penalty in Iraq over the killing of two colleagues is pleading with the British government for help. Danny Fitzsimmons is alleged to have shot two fellow private security guards dead during a drunken fight last year. His stepmother Liz says the 29-year-old was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because of his experiences in Kosovo and Afghanistan.
We need help. We need help from the British government, and we need help to try and save Danny's life. And we need fairness for our Danny.
A new file of evidence against either a peer or an MP over expenses has been passed to prosecutors. Meanwhile, four Lib Dem MPs have been ordered to repay money after an inquiry into their second home's expenses. Imperial Commander is the surprise winner of the Cheltenham Gold Cup. The 7-1 shot, ridden by Paddy Brennan, finished ahead of 2008 winner Denman. And Prince Harry has launched an expedition which will see injured troops trek to the North Pole. A team of ex-servicemen will take part in walking with the wounded in April next year. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Digital TV switchover is coming to the West Region in March. Everybody in Bristol needs to be ready.
Do you need help in switching to digital TV? If you are 75 or over, registered blind or partially sighted, or eligible for disability benefits, the Switchover Help Scheme offers practical help to convert one of your TV sets to digital. To get the help you are entitled to, you need to reply to the letter the Help Scheme has sent you. It's not too late. Fill out the application form and return it to us, or phone our free Help Scheme number 0800 4087656.
The Switchover Help Scheme is run by the BBC under agreement with the government. For further information, visit the website helpscheme.co.uk. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time. Martin, I'd just like to ask you, Martin Summers is joining me here. I'd like to ask you, were you convinced by Claire there? Because she was saying that it's more likely that the Liberal Party may go with Labour rather than Conservative if there's a hung Parliament. This is, the Liberals are going to be in a quite a key position, aren't they?
Well, if there is a hung Parliament, then they will be. But then other smaller parties may also be in a key position. Ulster Unionists, SNP, it could be fascinating. I was mainly concerned that the Liberal Party is not becoming, you know, is not losing its Liberal its Liberal focus. And I think Claire said that it wasn't. And I believe her. I think many Liberal activists would be very unhappy about propping up a Conservative government.
In a report carried over from last week, we ask, who is ex-SAS Major John Wick, the man with a copy of the private House of Commons hard drive who started the MP's expenses scandal? And we're joined by Chris Hawkins, ex-merchant banker and on the board of Barton Hills Community at Heart back in 2005. He'll be discussing the recession with Martin Summers. Will it double dip? We'll also be talking to Chris about his current work as part of the Child and Parent Alliance. And Lilia Patterson will be joining us. We'll be getting her impressions of her extensive travels in the Middle East. But before all that, some music. Stereo Lab, last week we played Ping Pong. This week, French Disco.
We'll be right back.
from 1993. That's Stereo Lab with French Disco. Now, last week saw the beginning of the four prosecutions of one MP and three peers who are facing criminal convictions of false accounting or fraud in connection with the MP's expenses crisis. The man who got the ball rolling in the expenses scandal, though, was ex-SAS Major John Wick. Now, let's have a listen to the only interview I could find that he'd given during this affair, which was released through the Daily Telegraph website last summer.
John, first of all, thank you very much for coming here and doing this interview with us.
My pleasure.
Can I start by talking about how you got involved in the whole process?
I got a phone call. Someone had been recommended to come and talk to me about a problem to do with the what became the expenses, the MP's expenses database. So I asked for a demonstration, and I sent a disc with five names on it. Those were the first things I looked at. And that was quite interesting. And even I could see on the there were three versions for each person. They covered 4 years. There was an unredacted version and two redacted versions. And the briefing I was given is the fees office had sent them back twice for MPs to cover and take things out. I think the biggest problem was knowing you had to do something but not knowing how violent the riding of the snake was going to be. We were going to hold on to something at the end and not know how long it was and how sharp its fangs were. But sometimes you just got to step out.
Now, there have been those who criticised the publication of this material for various different reasons. What do you say, first of all, to the argument that it would have come out anyway and that the parliamentary authorities were going to publish it in July and so this is just a media story?
Well, it's not going to come out as you have been publishing it, because you'd get the third redacted version. We've got two redacted versions of the third one being done. The stuff that comes out will be very highly, it would have been highly sensitised. I'm not sure now.
You're a Conservative Party supporter. You attend Conservative Party conference. Was there a hint at any, was there a feeling at any point that it would be nice if the other side was revealed, but not the Tories?
I think one knows as you get older and human nature, no, it's not going to be one party's good and one party's bad. The system, as I was briefed and then I saw, allows, the controls are fairly lax in the fees office on how claims are made. So if you look at the summary of the 120 people you've discussed on your paper, 50% of them in the middle have behaved within the rules. Maybe the public will think that the rules are soft and they've had too much money, but they have just used the system that they've been allowed to use. 25% at one end have been very good and haven't used the system, and 25% at the other end you've caught out in a big, big way, and they have abused it and maybe verging on fraud. That is the same across all parties, as you as the paper have actually shown.
So the reason for doing this, the what's behind it, is the need to have this information in the public domain?
Without a doubt, because without this, it sounds rather pompous, but without this it wouldn't have happened. We've all had, you as the media, we as the public, have had concerns about the expenses and how they've managed it, purely because how they've handled our request for information. We've reached a stage in society where they want to know everything about us. I think we're entitled to know about them.
Any regrets yet?
Oh, no.
No friends in the Conservative Party that
you've seen? Oh, I'm definitely not on people's Christmas card lists. But it has to be done. Parliament would be a better place. Society would be a better place. Sometimes the marker has to be put down. The public's put a marker down. It's good.
So that was Major, ex-Major from the SAS, John Wick, talking on the Daily Telegraph website. In fact, it's the only interview I could actually find with him. I don't think he spoke to the BBC or anybody else directly, just there on the Daily Telegraph website. So, Martin, who is this chap, this Major John Wick?
Well, I mean, we've only got limited information about him, haven't we? That's the only interview that he's given. He said at one stage that he'd leaked this information, which he got his hands on basically illegally through theft. Somebody must have stolen the hard drives. He said he was doing it because he was upset about the lack of equipment in Afghanistan, but he was also paid by the Telegraph for the material that he supplied. So there's a bit of a contradiction there. He's either doing it for the public interest or he's doing it because he's been paid, but he was definitely paid.
Well, what about the idea that how he actually obtained this? He must have... I don't know if he necessarily himself managed to get into the House of Commons Fees Office and copy the hard drive, but it is a bit worrying, isn't it? Because this is the sort of thing that intelligence services do all the time, is they will come in, sneak into somewhere where no one's looking, and they will copy over a load of data, and no one will even know they've been there.
Well, that's why the Speaker of the House of Commons, Michael Martin, called in the police, because it was obvious that they must have obtained this data through some kind of theft. It's all gone. I mean, the police eventually said that it was not in the public interest for them to look into this anymore. But of course, the suspicion has to be that this isn't just a random operation. That somebody is that the suggestion is that somebody had this stuff stolen to order, and then the Telegraph used the material that they'd got in a very, very suspicious way. They didn't publish all the details they had. What they did is it was a whole drip. And I understand that they phoned up. They spoke to Conservative Party leaders and gave them warning of what they were going to publish, whereas Labour MPs were phoned up and given 15 seconds to answer, we've got all this information about your expenses and this is being recorded, what do you have to say about
it? But listen, if I was the editor of the Daily Telegraph, I would be thinking exactly along the same lines. I want to drip this information out. There's absolutely no way I would put all of that information in one edition of the newspaper. The most sensible thing to do, surely, is over several months, make the most of the story. After all, they've paid for this information. They've given money to John Wick.
Yes, and there's a very good question. They paid for that information, but there was a theft at the start of the whole process. So the Telegraph could, in fact, be finding themselves, you've paid for something that has been stolen from the House of Commons. How did you get your hands on it?
Well, if there was ever to be a prosecution for that theft, there may well be the counter-argument. You're saying there won't be, but if there was ever a prosecution, surely the defence would be, well, it's in the public interest for this information to come out.
Well, I think that's the caravan's now moved on. I mean, everybody is aware that the MP's expenses have been abused. But, of course, it was a very, very handy thing for the bankers that we spent 6 months baying after £4,000 moats and all the rest of it. And some of the stuff they were saying, so-and-so applied for something, but they didn't even get it. Yeah, so they applied for something, they didn't get it, and they were pilloried for that. So many politicians who actually are much worse paid than private sector leadership, many of them quite dedicated, in all genuine honesty, made mistakes in claiming things and have been pilloried. And the whole political process has been undermined by this. And of course, I think people have wised up. They've realised that the amount of money, all of it, the investigation of this has cost more than all the expenses put together. And all of the expenses put together aren't worth one banker's bonus. And this is a great big distraction, in my view.
Well, this is an interesting angle to it all. What about the accounting in the City of London? I mean, we've been hearing all sorts of dodgy things about Lehman Brothers and accounting firms in the Central London, the City of London, who were involved in that. That was another story that's come out.
The former head of Lehman Brothers was in the press this week saying people think $50 billion is a lot of money, but in actual fact, it's chicken feed. They're just ignorant non-professionals. They don't understand. They were hiding $50 billion in an off-balance sheet account, which is actually probably fraud. I mean, a lot of what's been going on is fraudulent.
Well, I'd like to introduce Chris Hawkins to the studio. Hi, Chris.
Hello there. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You were on the board of the Regeneration Project in Barton Hill Community at Heart for 2 years, around 2005, and you worked at a merchant bank at the Astley Trust for 7 years before that. What are your thoughts on the reporting of the banking fraud as against the way that the parliamentary expenses crisis has been reported?
I think I wouldn't disagree with Martin here that... in some ways, it's been rather a red herring. If we go back to 1997, and maybe a little bit earlier, one of the things that became apparent to the government was that to stimulate the economy, that perhaps a little loosening of the reins would assist banks in generating income for the nation. Unfortunately, Gordon Brown decided that the Bank of England had always controlled how banks behaved. It weren't necessary and would transfer the control of banking over to the FSA.
That's the Financial Services Authority.
That's right, yes. Who had no experience of regulating institutions. And regrettably, we followed the American view on this, that anything goes. And the banks obviously took advantage of it. When I was involved in banking, if you lent money, you wanted to be certain that the person you were lending the money to could repay it. But we had the ludicrous situation of Northern Rock, who were lending money to individuals at rates of interest which were quite competitive, but allowing them to borrow up to 7 or even 10 times their supposed incomes, because they also decided that you didn't need to provide proof of your income. Well, that's a recipe for disaster. Okay, whilst your income's good, you're going to be able to repay. But in the current economic climate, you start defaulting. And then there was the other great idea, I suppose, in a way, like some of the scams the politicians pulled, you pretend that you've got an asset which is worth a lot more than it is in reality. And apparently, envelopes containing mortgage documents were being sold on, which is where a lot of people like the Royal Bank of Scotland came unstuck because they'd bought things which weren't worth the paper that they were written on, which is okay whilst you're in boom conditions, but when you have to start realising some of those assets, you run into trouble.
Now, Martin, I just handed you an article about the Lehman Brothers. Could you just explain why? I mean, this is one of the things that flummoxes me about all this thing to do with the MPs. The MPs have had a very great exposure in all the press about what eventually looks like it may be accounting mismanagement of their accounts and potential fraud for four of them, but most of them, of course, haven't. But this article about Lehman Brothers implies that actually it was City of London institutions that were instrumental in the collapse of that bank.
Well, the City of London actually prided itself on being more deregulated than Wall Street. So messy, dirty things that Wall Street wouldn't touch, the City of London, arbitraged itself to be the place where these kind of things would go on. Basically, Elliot Spitzer, who used to be Attorney General in New York, said one of the problems is even the existing rule book is being flouted. And he was got rid of by a call girl scandal. He had a $1,000 call girl come to his hotel room, and immediately the financial press and everybody leaped on him. He was hoofed out of his office, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in actual fact, he was determining, he was saying, look, and he's on the internet now saying, look, what's been going on is fraudulent. Even under the existing lax regulations, it's been fraudulent.
So how come these frauds are not being investigated?
Because anything goes, as Chris has just pointed out. One of the other problems, of course, is when you're lending money, they've invented the collateralized debt obligations and structured investment vehicles. So you lend money to somebody, then you slice and dice that up into another product, and you sell that onto a third party. So you've got no interest in whether this person can pay or not. Once you've just had to find a bigger fool to buy it at the end of the line, and they're suddenly realising that all of these CDOs, which are cheap, it's insurance on the cheap, isn't it? Insurance on the cheap, and they seem to be well priced because in actual fact they ain't worth what they're priced at. If they mark to market, it's probably worth about 10 to 20 cents on the dollar, and that's not what's going to happen because the whole of the banking system is stuffed with this rubbish now, which would never have been allowed to occur. It's just absurd that they were allowed to do this.
Okay, anyway, we'll be getting back to Chris Hawkins' take on the economic situation and asking him about his present work for the Child and Parent Alliance after some music from Fluke. This is their version of the old New Order song Blue Monday. and the song was Blue Monday, the well-known old New Order song. Now, ex-merchant banker, ex-community activist in Barton Hill, now working with the Child and Parent Alliance, Chris Hawkins is joining me. Chris, you say you were a merchant banker. What is a merchant bank?
Some of the activities which the Royal Bank of Scotland and Northern Rock indulged in, rather badly, and lots of indiscretions. We used to lend money to people who wanted to set themselves up public liability companies. Fortunately, I never was involved in that. I was more on the commercial operation side of our activities. And I would be lending money to people who wanted to purchase machinery and equipment, where the joint stock bank had rather prudently in those days said that they weren't interested in lending money, so that we would lend on a long-term basis compared with the normal periods of repayment.
So it sounds like you were doing more risky loans, maybe.
We were.
And so is that one of the reasons why you think that the crisis has hit these merchant banks so much more, is because that they were taking massive risks or smaller risks or bigger risks than the high street banks?
Well, if we name some individuals here, the Halifax, the Royal Bank of Scotland, to a certain degree Lloyds, didn't split the more riskier parts of their activities from the normal man-in-the-street operations, you know, taking your monthly salary check and allowing you to draw on it, arranging small overdraft facilities. They started getting involved in derivatives, and unfortunately, we haven't got 3 or 4 hours to talk about the kind of...
Did you say unfortunately?
Yes. Derivatives, any commodity in the financial sense of the word, which doesn't fall into a simple transaction basis. I suppose in some ways, going back into history, things like the South Sea bubble, where people speculated.
When was that? Obviously, it's in the South Sea somewhere. But when?
The early part of the 18th century, where people invested money into the growing of cotton, but there weren't any real businesses there. Now, looking at our banks, and the executives have escaped scot-free, no prosecutions, because really they were acting like con men. They were selling products which didn't really exist. They were taking the most enormous risks. As I said, one of the examples I gave you was that people were borrowing money and being lent amounts which were 10 times their normal annual income. No way could they repay that. They weren't being asked for proof of their income. And if you haven't got any income, then you can't repay a debt. The other thing is Northern Rock, for instance, specialised in purchasing for letting. Well, that's fantastic whilst you can let your properties, but if you're repaying the capital out of the rentals and the market becomes depressed, you can't repay. So there are all these factors, and what we've ended up with is that the ordinary man in the street is going to be asked to pick up enormous bills. Probably the average person aged 30-35 will be still expected to be paying off the debts which the government have incurred by bailing out the banks.
Well, what are your thoughts about the wisdom of bailing out the banks? Was that the right thing to do last year?
I think it was, but I think the government didn't go far enough. because virtually they were doing something which the Labour Party were very keen on 50 years ago, and that was nationalising the banks. Well, if you nationalise, you then take control and you instruct the executives running those banks how they should conduct themselves.
So did the government now turn up at shareholders meetings and things, or sort of wave bits of paper saying, hang on, we've got shares in the bank, we have something
to say. They don't seem to be asserting any control at all. I mean, they're trying to go for hands, you know, hands off. We don't know enough about this, leave it to the professionals.
Yeah. So how on earth are the banks and the senior people in these banks able to convince the Treasury to just sort of go away rather than to intervene?
I think quite possibly it's because of the close links that some government ministers have with the banks, and also some of the civil servants. It's quite amazing how often when someone retires from a ministerial post, you find two or three of their directorships are in the banking sector.
In the United States, don't forget that Wall Street and the Big Five on Wall Street are the main funders of the political process. So once Obama was selected as the Democratic nominee for president, Wall Street waded in behind him. You know, he had this mythology that he's actually came to power on the basis of lots of small donations. Well, that was true to begin with, but once he was the candidate, Wall Street waded in behind him and poured loads of money into his coffers. And of course, they expect to pay off for that. And can I just pick up a point that Chris made about banks and merchant banks? When you were working for a merchant bank, that was separate, was it not, from a main high street bank?
Yes, correct.
I mean, the Glass-Steagall Act was brought in the 1930s in the US after a similar mistakes were made in the run up to the 1929 crash, and the Glass-Steagall Act was brought in to separate investment banking, merchant banking, from run of the mill banking, and that regulation remained in place right until the 1990s, and then Wall Street lobbied to get rid of it. They got rid of it, and then the predictable happened. Once you mixed up high street banking and merchant banking, all the merchant banking messed up the high street banking. If merchant banks go bust taking risks, that's their problem. But if they're integrated into the mainstream system, then they have to be rescued, because you can't let everybody's deposits go down the hole. But I mean, those regulations were put in place for a reason, and then when you take them away, it doesn't work. That's why they were there in the first place.
I absolutely agree with that, and it was very interesting that after Lehman Brothers were allowed to collapse, that suddenly the British government, followed by the Americans, suddenly realised that if you allowed the whole of the financial sector to collapse, because there were a number of banks that would have gone under, that capitalism, as we know it, would have been practically destroyed, because we rely upon the movement of money to oil the wheels of industry, to ensure that everyone gets their pensions at the end of the week or month, and that our hospitals, all our educational facilities, schools, universities, all use the banking system to borrow money until they get funding back in. I mean, people always think that the government has these huge wads of money to pay for the way that the country ticks over, but they do not. They have to rely upon tax revenues coming in, and to tide that over, they need a vibrant banking system to ensure that they get their overdrafts, that when they're raising money by the selling of stocks, gilts that we call them, the banks and the financial institutions, our insurance companies, buy those gilts. And at the present moment, it would appear that because we're no longer really a AAA risk, which means that the financial world doesn't consider that we could repay our debts, and the Greeks are going through this problem as well, that eventually interest rates will be forced up. The man in the street will be forced to limit its expenditure, because as interest rates go up, mortgages will increase, but because we're in dire straits as far as economic progress is concerned, you won't be able to ask for wage increases. So once again, we will be paying for the sins of our masters.
Well, our society is absolutely reliant on money ever since we stopped being subsistence farmers. But surely capitalism isn't the only way of managing money. Surely, you know, a socialistic kind of system where the Treasury and the government is managing money and making sure that money is wherever it's needed, isn't that a viable alternative to a capitalist system of private banking?
Unfortunately, it doesn't appear to be. Because the Russians tried the system. The French also tried a much more hands-on method of running their economies. And it may be that politicians are no different from bankers. So that in the totalitarian states, you had people who were doing extremely well out of the economy, but the average man in the street, as any Russian would have told you during the 1950s and 1960s, struggled to exist.
I think there are wider questions about, you know, socialism versus capitalism or whatever, but I think there's a strong case for having a solid state basis to some parts of the financial system, and I would adduce in this case the Bank of North Dakota, which is actually owned by the
state. Oh, you mentioned them last week.
Yeah, it's actually owned by the state of North Dakota, and it was put in place in the early 1900s as a result of pressure from farmers, really, because they were fed up of borrowing money at interest from Wall Street and then being foreclosed on and losing their farms and so on. So there was a big political push in North Dakota to set up a state-run bank. That state-run bank still exists. It creates credit for North Dakota. And in actual fact, North Dakota is actually doing far better than all the other US states. They've actually still got growth in North Dakota. Unemployment is falling. And that doesn't mean you get rid of private banks completely, but they have to compete against well-run state banks.
Well, I wonder if you think
that puts them up to the mark.
I wonder if you think that's a viable way forward, Chris. And also, I'd also like to ask you, if you found yourself in Alistair Darling's position, how you might manage the affairs right now?
Well, prior to 1997, possibly, I think it was the time that Margaret Thatcher was in control of the country, the Bank of England had a role which was very similar to the Bank of Dakota. They were the lenders of last resort. But in lending to a bank which was having difficulties, they would ensure that it wasn't our money that was used to bail out that bank. The rest of the banking world in the UK would have to either take part in a merger or lend that bank in difficulties. And also, they were controlling these banks. They were saying to them, yes, you can indulge in speculative-type activities in your banking activities, but you must increase your cash ratios. Your reserve had to be increased, which is, you know, one way of tackling this problem. We have suffered from the fact that Gordon Brown reduced all these controls, which were never put in writing, but were there, that the governor of the Bank of England or his deputy would be talking to the joint stock banks, merchant banks, and saying, look, it appears that you need to have a look at your liquidity ratios, or even going as far as saying you must look for someone to merge with, because if you don't, you're going to be wound up.
I forgot time to say something.
I was just going to ask Chris. Look, I did ask you, what would you do? Is there one or two things that you think that would the Chancellor really should do to set things on the right course, sort of fundamental changes?
The key, I think, to what happens over the next 2 or 3 years is restoring confidence in the country. That they use this beautiful expression, UK limited. And the only way you're going to do that is to demonstrate that you can, as we as individuals do, we sit down and we budget. And if we're spending too much money, we have to reduce our spending. So Alistair Darling is pretending that he can leave this for another 12 months. Ken Clark, I think, was absolutely right. I was listening to him on television a couple of days ago when he said, just saying that you're going to start as soon as you're back in power after the election will be sufficient to restore that confidence. So that is what Alistair Darling must do. If the Labour Party are returned to power.
Martin.
Yeah, I was just pointing out that the reserve ratios have been allowed to get completely out of line. Bernanke, who's the head of the...
Can you explain what a reserve ratio is?
Chris explained what it was about earlier. I mean, if a bank's engaged in risky activities, it's got to increase... You know, it used to have to increase its reserves and so on. But what's actually been allowed to happen, they've been allowed to run ridiculous leverages on their basic monetary base. And Bernanke, who's the head of the Federal Reserve, or is he the Federal Reserve? He's the Federal Reserve, isn't he? He was saying, we've got to get rid of all kind of reserve ratios altogether. So they're still talking this complete sort of lunacy free market stuff. The reserve ratios are completely inadequate as they are. And he's saying, well, they create distortions, so let's just get rid of them. Now, this is the road to madness. I mean,
Chris, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, if I can draw an analogy with most of us, when we buy a house and we have a mortgage on it and we want an overdraft, the bank will say to us, well, fine, but we must secure this on your asset. And, okay, some people did go into negative equity, i.e. their houses weren't the same value as they had, or a less value than the money which had been advanced against them. So the banks, with their assets, which... had to be properly evaluated because they weren't before they can indulge in any kind of business at all.
Right, let's round up with a poem from the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter, called Round and Round.
Let's call Round and Round. The money rattles round and round while we are ground into the ground. The dollar, yen and mighty pound make us aggravated. The bankers take their profits out, we are ripped off, and so we doubt what this strange system is about. Is it overrated? Nobody knows quite what to do, the government don't have a clue, they're as confused as me and you. That is why I sound off. Our money should be safe and sound, my patience is now overwound, we have lost more than we have found, so I'm feeling browned off. There is nowhere that we can turn. The more we work, the less we earn, while bankers still have cash to burn and spend on the election. Should we make cuts or should we spend? Who has some money they can lend? What can help us in the end? Send in your suggestion.
That was Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. And indeed, send in your suggestion. My email address here is tony@bcfm.org.uk. Always welcome to hear all sorts of ideas about how to sort out this economic mess. Anyway, now back to Chris Hawkins, who's joining us, who's an ex-merchant banker. But you're not just an ex-merchant banker, are you, Chris? Can you tell us about your work now with the Child and Parent Alliance? Who are they and what do you do?
Right, the Child and Parent Alliance is a self-help support group for children and parents after... the parents have run into difficulties with marriages or relationships. And one of the problems, again, with governments indulging in, to a certain degree, social engineering, one of the things which has happened over the last 50 years, it had become so easy to... break up a marriage without really considering what happens to the children. 20 years ago, the government realised that this was happening and introduced something called the Children Act. And an integral part of that was that children had to be looked after first before you dealt with the financial aspects of a marriage, dividing up the assets between husband or husband and wife, or as they were, before you could be divorced. But only lip service has been paid to that since. So we've now have the situation where the Office of National Statistics published some figures about 12 months ago, which have now come to fruition, and that is that in the UK at the present moment, there's something like 2.5 million children who do not live with both of their biological parents. A million of those will not even see their... it's usually the father, in some cases it's the mother, but after the breakdown of relationship, you have a what the courts call a resident parent and a non-resident parent. The children normally obviously reside with the resident parent, and the non-resident parent has contact with the child. But a million of these, according to the government, children are not having any contact at all. Many of the other 1.5 million of the 2.5 million only have limited contact. The court will often say there's been a satisfactory outcome to the case when a child may be only seeing the father for 2 or 4 hours a month. What we would like to see is something called shared parenting introduced. And it doesn't mean that the children spend 50% of their time with each parent, but at least you start from that basis and then you decide how much time that a child can spend with the non-resident parent. Shared parenting is a necessity, because most psychologists are now saying that one of the reasons there's so much of a problem with children as far as behaviour is concerned is that they're being brought up in insecure circumstances with a single parent. So what we do as an organisation is we try and smooth out the problems that occur when people split up. Children feel guilty. They sometimes feel they're part of the problem then. And they need to feel that they are wanted by both parents.
Okay, Chris. Can you just tell us how to contact the Child and Parent Alliance if people are interested in finding out more or coming along to meetings or just even finding you on the internet?
Right. We have a website, and it is childandparentalliance.com. The email address is childandparentalliance@yahoo.co.uk. A telephone number, 0117 931 5918.
Lovely, thanks very much. Coming up next, we talk to an old friend of mine and Middle East traveller, Lilia Patterson. But before that, some more music. This one from 1997. The band is Air, and the song is All I Need.
My weight, all I need is peace this mind I can celebrate. All in all, there's something to give.
All in all, there's something to give.
All in all, there's
to do.
Oh, now there's something to do.
Oh, now there's something to live.
His ways. All I need's a place to find, and there I'll celebrate. All in all, there's something to give.
All in all, there's something to give.
All in all, there's something to do.
All in all, there's something to do.
All in all, there's something to live.
With All I Need. Now I'm joined by Lilia Patterson, who's been travelling extensively over the last 6 years between her home in Oxford and the Middle East. Hi Lilia, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony. Yes, you are right. You are an old friend. And partly my travels were inspired by learning about different political situations, also learning about different environmental issues, and also learning about land rights issues.
Well, because you and I used to work on land rights in Oxford as part of the Land is Ours campaign with who's now a Guardian columnist, George Monbiot. Do you think that work on the right to roam here in Britain and the right to housing affect the way you saw things in the Middle East?
Well, that's right. And what I learnt in Oxford was that there were different ideologies which different people were following, which essentially interlinked. And I first went to Egypt on a diving holiday, but then I was just fascinated with the culture. And then when I came back, I just thought, I want to go and I want to learn more. And I went, you know, I wanted to go to, I went to Israel and Palestine.
So you went over there essentially as a tourist to begin with,
in
doing diving.
That's
and then
right.
Just decided to go back and take maybe more time and as an independent traveller.
Well, that's right. So I went as an independent traveller, but I went with a camera. What I did was I made films with people, and I made films with some of the Bedouin about very, very simple things, like about the simple traditions like fishing, you know, about camels, about singing,
So who are the Bedouin and what were they like to live with?
Well, the thing about the Bedouin is that nowadays, obviously, they're affected by tourism, and that's the main way that they make their livelihood. But at the same time, they're also marginalised, partly because their lifestyle, in a sense, means that they've always been outside of civilization, and they're a very private people. But at the same time, what I learnt about them is that they live in a very, very simple way still, and I learnt a lot from them. Because when you live in that sort of culture and you realise people are living in essentially in emptiness, you know, living in the desert, you have practically nothing. It means that you actually value the little that you have, you know, and it really changed my view about the world, you know, coming back to England and just seeing how much stuff there is.
Well, what's your biggest concern, though, for the region, do you
well,
think?
My biggest concern actually is... it's about, I mean, obviously conflict is a very big issue and people don't realise how it affects people out there. I mean, they're all struggling. They're all struggling to survive. They don't have the same security as we have here. And obviously, I mean, when I travelled in, I mean, I only travelled in the West Bank, but when I travelled in Israel and Palestine, I mean, that it affects the whole area and it causes tension throughout the whole area.
You were saying also that there's quite a criminal element in Israel that many people don't know is there.
Well, that's right. People don't realise that, for example, at the end of communism in Russia, there was actually 500,000 prisoners who were released from prisons because the state couldn't maintain them. And basically, it was very easy for them to get papers to Israel based on fake ID saying...
So were they actually Jewish or is that, could they just get fake ID to say
I'm
they
saying,
were?
I'm saying it's very, very easy. And even in Israel today, it's very easy for people to convert to Judaism. And unfortunately, what happens is you get a lot of people who are using the fact that they're military trained and then they get exploited. So it means that there's a lot of military elements which are mixed with criminal elements, unfortunately, and it means there's a lot of corruption and it's causing the Palestinians to really suffer.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Lydia. I'm sure we could talk about much longer about that, and maybe we will do a subsequent time. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Henleys and Bristol Cabinet Member for Children and Young People earlier on, Claire Campion-Smith. Next week at 5 on Friday drive time, Chair of Bristol City Council's Licensing Committee, Mary Sykes, will be here. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.